monthly Board of Commissioners meeting. May we all rise and engage in the Pledge of Allegiance.
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Okay, good. All right, may we now have our roll call.
Good evening, Commissioners. I'll take the roll call. Chair Hartwig.
I am present.
Vice Chair Merlene Hurt.
Present.
Jenny Castillo.
Present.
Donna Griggs Murphy. Commissioners excused. Commissioner Montgomery.
Present.
Commissioner Griffith
is excused
as well. And Commissioner Jung Lee. Thank you.
Okay. Approval of last month's minutes. Do we have a motion?
Move to approve.
Move to approve.
Commissioner Hurd.
Second. Okay.
I wasn't here also.
I'll second.
Okay, we do have a second then. Okay. All those in favor, aye.
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed? Abstentions? Okay. You have an abstention due to absence. All right. So now moving on to old or unfinished business.
There is none.
There is none. Uh-huh. Modifications to the agenda. Hearing none. So we will move forward with new business. Item A.
Item A comes once a year. It is consideration of a resolution approving the Oakland Housing Authority's fiscal year 2020 Making Transitions Work, or MTW plan. And I'd like to introduce, first I want to thank the Planning, Implementation, and Compliance, both Julie Christensen and the Director Dominic Henderson, for preparing this year's plan. It's always a lot more work than it looks, and the report is even more work than that, I think. So I appreciate their work, and I will turn it over to Dominica, who will walk us through a presentation.
Good evening, Commissioners. Today I will just go through a more brief overview than the last presentation we had on the plan. So to begin, the presentation outline will include an overview of the plan, a glossary of acronyms and common phrases that are used throughout the plan and maybe even during this presentation. I'll review the timeline for the MTW plan process, provide a high level of overview of the challenges and the proposed short-term solutions that we expect to use during the plan year. The presentation will also then continue by reviewing the long-term strategic investments that OHA plans to make and describes throughout the plan to create institutionalized reforms that really ensure that the challenges that we see today are not something that will reoccur over the long term. And then I will wrap up the presentation by reviewing some items in the plan that were edited during the public comment period or that may have been even added, including the RAD significant amendment and the details that are included in the significant amendment and the public comments that we received during the public comment period and some other sort of ancillary modifications that we made just to make sure that there is clarification in the plan.
Okay, so we've actually made some changes to the plan based on the public comments.
Some slight edits to the plan, as well as some proposed actions that we will take as well based on the comments we received. This is the glossary, just in case you need to refer back to it for some of the acronyms that we use. The timeline for the annual plan began when we published a public announcement and notice of public hearing in the Oakland Tribune on February 1st, 2019. The public comment period started on February 7th, 2019, which is the same day that the community partners were notified of the draft plan being available and also of the public hearing that we had. The public hearing occurred on February 11th and then was followed up with visits to the RAB on February 13th and then again on March 13th. And the public comment period then closed on March 8th. And we have to submit the plan by April 15th. The submission of the plan The action today is to authorize the executive director to submit the plan as well as to execute the certifications of compliance, just affirming that we are within compliance and intend to be in compliance with the MTW requirements that are stated in the agreement. This slide reviews OHA's planned short-term responses to various challenges experienced in the Oakland rental market. We went through these in great detail last board meeting. So I just want to give a brief kind of statement about what you see in front of you. Looking at the purple section, OHA, it shows that OHA will launch the automatic rent increase activity as a solution to a low voucher utilization and low vacancy. We anticipate that this automatic rent increase activity will use mapping and other advanced technical analyses to identify rapidly changing neighborhoods where OHA also has a significant number of vouchers so that we're able to make sure that we're stabilizing housing for in-place families and offering landlords a reasonable rent increase that's based on actual neighborhood level data and not just the potential whims of a landlord wanting a rent increase. To follow that up, and in order to counter the challenge of affordability, of the affordability crisis and homelessness, we show here in the green arrow that OHA intends to continue its work to incentivize owners to join or remain participants in the Housing Choice Voucher Program. We will launch the Repair Assistance Program, which is was approved, obviously, with all the other landlord incentives, but we have not yet launched that activity. So we intend to launch that during fiscal year 2020, as well as continue to offer the signing bonus to recruit new landlords, promote the Inspect Now, Rent Later activity, as well as expand the re-rent payment option for owners. These activities seek to provide a more stable housing in the rental market while increasing the number of apartments that are available to the Housing Choice Voucher families that are in Oakland looking to lease apartments. Finally, in the blue arrow, you'll see that OHA plans to counter the challenge of the diminishing and uncertain federal resources by leveraging its partnerships with local agencies, as well as with third-party property managers and developers to serve additional families outside of the traditional Section 8 and Section 9 or public housing programs. OHA will increase the number of families served in the local housing assistance programs that we have, which include Building Bridges and the Sponsor-Based Housing Assistance Program. And we'll also capitalize on some partnership opportunities using RAD and also using the disposition tool that we have at access to reposition our assets to more financially favorable position, and so that they're less reliant on federal subsidies. The solutions I mentioned on this slide are discussed in greater detail in Section 4 of the MTW plan for your reference. Moving on to the more long-term investments, this slide and the following two slides demonstrate the methodical process that the leadership team plans to use to strengthen the foundation of the agency to be protected from challenges mentioned in the previous slide, as well as, you know, protected the agency from any other challenges that may arise in the future. These long-term solutions that I'll discuss over the next three slides are primarily found in Section 5, where we talk about funding flexibility and fungibility of the MTW plan. And these activities are designed to permanently offset challenges experienced by low-income families in Oakland through offering services-enriched housing assistance similar to OHA's PACT program. We intend to start an abatement relief fund, which is new. We're proposing that in this plan, actually, to assist residents that are forced to vacate units through no fault of their own due to failed HQS inspections. We also intend to promote the OHAPD initiative, such as the Citizens Police Academy and VIPs, as well as we hope to refine the education initiative quite a bit to use some data analysis over the past several years that we've collected through our partnership with OUSD to expand the initiative and include older students in some activities, as well as repeat best practices that we've seen at some of our partner schools, including Parker Elementary and West Oakland Middle School. OHA's second strategic investment area that's discussed in the plan or throughout the plan is in the area of program administration. OHA will complete renovation of its administrative offices, increase its technical capacity and expertise by maximizing the new Yardi 7S product, as well as employing other software tools like Tableau and GIS for better predictive modeling of housing trends in the area. OHA will also use some national and some local best practices and lessons learned to become more efficient in the delivery of housing assistance for OHA program participants. And we intend to refine our operational activities like the alternative recertifications, which is the biennial research that we state on the slide, so as to maximize the time spent by the participant and also to minimize the amount of time that's spent by the participant in completing some routine activities, and to maximize our time saved on the staff side so that we can use some of the efficiencies that we gain in other areas or increasing housing programs for local housing assistance programs. Yes.
I just want to be clear, the third one, that's in practice now, or we're still waiting to activate
the biennial,
shouldn't it be biannual recertifications?
We have a version of alternative recertifications. Right now we propose an annual, a biennial, and a triennial. And okay. What we've learned over the past couple of years is that we need to modify the alternative recertification schedule so that we're able to best capitalize on what the business system can do, and also to make sure that we're maximizing the efficiencies that we've learned. So we are using it now, but what we are proposing is to modify the activity slightly so that we think that we can basically capitalize on some efficiencies that we have gained over time.
So get more control of it.
I would say more control over it, sure, but I think it's more or less what we're trying to do is make sure that we have the right residents and participants on the right schedule.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Okay, gotcha. Thank you.
No, just this is a question on the, I think you mentioned some kind of acronyms or something referring to some software programs.
Yes.
Was that what it was?
Yes.
So that refers to the predictive modeling?
Yes. Well, we, as I've mentioned in a couple of the presentations that we've had, we have some new staff that are able to do a little bit more fancy, use technologies that we haven't used in the past. So we are using some mapping software, which I think the police department uses.
What software?
Mapping software like GIS. The police department currently uses a version of it, but we are able to use the mapping software to identify certain areas maybe where we have higher concentration, or it could be that we're using the mapping software to find, what new parks are in within a certain radius of certain sites, or what maybe new developments are in certain areas, just to be able to help us better understand the market on a more micro level, on a neighborhood level. And so Dr. Stephanie Hawk, who's not here today, is using the mapping to help us create that automatic rent increase activity that I mentioned.
I see. Mm-hmm. So would you then be able to do more micro breakdowns than zip codes?
Yeah, we should be able to do it by zip code, but we also are really trying to gear our analyses towards census tract, or towards more, because the zip codes don't necessarily define neighborhoods as we experience them in real time.
Right.
And so we are using some more, I guess it would be, we're able to use some anecdotal experience to be able to define certain areas that we want to look at. We also are able to use census tract and different data sets that we get from different sources. So we've gotten used census data. We've used some HUD data that is not necessarily based on the census. We can also use our internal data and map that. And so we can see, based on the voucher participants that we have and the addresses we have there and in public housing, we can do some kind of cool mapping things that then can create nice pictures and help us visually understand what's happening in the market, because it's sometimes a little bit more complicated to explain it when we're looking at big data sets. Mm-hmm. So
And much easier if you geo, what she's talking about is geo-basing them on a map, so you can look at where.
Yeah, right. No, I think that that's actually
and one
really
of our proposals for from to HUD in terms of this activity for granting rent increases is that we would define our own rental markets.
Yes.
That you couldn't in zip codes and you couldn't in census tracts. And when they were doing small area rents, I actually met with folks at HUD to explain to them that within any census tract or any zip code in Oakland, you had extremely affluent neighborhoods and you have extremely impoverished neighborhoods.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And all you were going to do is push all of the rents up in the impoverished neighborhoods because that was going to be the overall rent.
Right.
And it wasn't going to have an impact on the extremely wealthy neighborhoods or gentrified neighborhoods. And they understood that, so they took us out of that mandate. We were removed from it. We were one of, I think, the only or two jurisdictions that ended up mm-hmm. getting removed out of it. But what I did propose under MTW is that we would define our own rental market. So we could say between San Pablo and Market going up between 48th and 28th, we've had a big increase in rent in that neighborhood
mm-hmm.
and be at that detail. We just haven't had the capacity, mm-hmm. but I would tell you our Stephanie is great, and our data is there if we can find a way to read it and use it correctly.
I see, and now we have the data to back that up.
Mm-hmm. And so, we have the staff to be able to demonstrate it in a way that will help you make policy decisions going forward that we just haven't had the capacity in the past to be able to use.
So now, were there other market trends that you're trying to use predictive software for as well, or is that pretty much the focus?
I think that is the starting place.
Yeah, okay,
I think that
cool.
as questions come up, we always are.
Okay.
Okay.
Thank you.
I just had one more question.
Yes.
Special populations, what's that listing?
Well, we have a variety of what we are calling special needs populations. Mm-hmm. So that ranges from the families that are served and the parents and children together or PAC program. That's a reentry. I guess it's family unification programs that we have different angles for. So for PAC, it's reentry. And then we also serve various special populations, whether it's formerly homeless, juveniles emancipated foster youth, maybe even folks that are reentering from the criminal justice system that were emancipated foster youth. We also serve chronically homeless families under the sponsor-based program. So it's a long list of special needs populations that we serve. And we also have built into this MTW plan the ability to create additional special needs or define additional special needs populations as we determine them. And because we have this an ability to analyze the data even more deeply, we're able to see it may be that we want to serve a special needs population that we have not necessarily discovered yet, but we know that we have a intense homeless issue in Oakland. And so what we hope to do is be able to further define those populations, and we've built in the opportunity to be able to serve them through our MTW local programs as well.
All right, thank you.
Okay. And so finally, for the final strategic investment, OHA plans significant investment in capital improvements through RAD refinancing at the mixed finance sites, as well as the renovation of the headquarters, as well as the housing above us, the 100 units of affordable housing, public housing above us. And we also intend to expand affordable housing through projects like Brooklyn Basin, Empyrean, as well as 15th and Harrison. As described in the MTW plan, OHA seeks to magnify its impact by securing or adding long-term stable housing units to the city's affordable housing portfolio. And we hope to update our administrative facilities to ensure prompt, high-quality service delivery to participants and to property owners and other visitors. Moving on to some additional items. So this is part of the presentation that will discuss some things that we modified just to provide some clarifications today in today's presentation as well as in the plan. There were a few things that we added after the public hearing. And so one of them is a more clear depiction of the public housing units that will be converted to a different program, housing assistance program. All of the public housing units that are listed on this, or apartments that are listed on this chart, will be transitioned to project-based voucher by the end of fiscal year 2020. This action will bring the total number of OHA public housing apartments to just over 1,000, about 1,046 And so we currently have 1,606 public housing units, and this reducing public housing side by 560 units will move those public housing units over to the project-based voucher program using one of these tools. Either it'll be a RAD or it'll be a disposition unit. And so they will be PBV. They will continue to be assisted to the same levels that the families are assisted currently under the public housing program, but they will be in a different subsidy. I'll describe a little bit more, and I actually will also invite Dave Cadu, the Senior Director of Real Estate Development, up as well to talk about RAD. But I did want to just make sure that we list out the units that we're proposing to convert to project-based voucher from the public housing side. So they're not going to be, they will still be affordable. They will just be in a new program. Another factor that we added to the MTW plan was a more thorough draft of the RAD significant amendment, which is required by HUD for all annual plans that propose RAD activities. The significant amendment includes a description of the sites and the units down to the bedroom size. We describe policies outlining eligibility and occupancy after the units become project-based voucher units. We provide a description of how OHA will manage the reduction of capital funds as a result of moving the units from the public housing program to a different subsidy. And we finally outline the various tenant protections that are required as part of RAD and are discussed a little bit on the next slide, a little bit later in the presentation. So like I said, if you have any questions that are specific about the RAD program, then I'm sure Dave would be the better person to ask those. But we did make some significant changes by including the significant amendment. We wanted to make sure that even though we have, it's called a significant amendment to our plan, but we haven't proposed any RAD activities, so we weren't sure if it was something that we needed to include because amendment makes it seem like it's a change. HUD got back to us and let us know we did need to include the significant amendment, and then we had to follow the sort of the definitions and the description that's provided in the HUD guidance. And so that is a significant modification that we made as a result of some HUD guidance that we received during the public comment period.
I just have one question. Oh, go ahead, Ms. Pemble-Cummings.
The RAD program, is that something new that I need to elaborate on that a little bit to understand?
The RAD program is the Rental Assistance Demonstration Program that was proposed and implemented during the Obama administration. It was to move public housing sites from public housing onto an equivalent project-based Section 8 environment so you could actually refinance and make improvements. It gives no more money to the program than the public housing program. So it became very popular within jurisdictions where public housing actually cash flows. And throughout the country, they had a lot of people who've converted to RAD because it helps them preserve the property. In San Francisco, they did an enormously large RAD conversion, and Mr. Cadu was involved in all those deals, so he knows it intimately, and I will let him talk in one moment. But the purpose of RAD for us, it doesn't really cash flow for us, except for in the mixed finance deals. So what Dave is talking about are only those units that are included in Lion Creek Crossing, Mandela, Foothill, Chestnut, Linden, right?
Correct.
No others. And those are because they've already designed those whole redevelopments to survive off the public housing operating assistance, so it works. Right. What it gets the management side of that is then they're just managing basically the tax credit with Section 8. They don't have the third kind of compliance that they have to do. The people who live there will get one less inspection because they won't have the REAC inspection. They'll have HQS. The managers have to do the same kind of eligibility that they do for the Section 8 units, so they don't have to do a separate entitlements for public housing. And that seemed enticing. And the other thing we know is that the president is now proposing to cut public housing assistance by 50%.
Yes.
So this is a way to preserve the funding at the current level. Having turned that over, I will turn over to Mr. Cadeau.
Frankly, I think that Mr. Johnson covered most of the salient points. If there are other specific questions you have about it, I'm more than happy to address them. But, yeah, this is mostly a move to do a couple of things. Number one, shore up our long-term cash flow by insulating ourselves from the cuts to the public housing budget. And number two, to dramatically reduce the compliance burden on the managers of our mixed finance sites.
So. And the fundamental difference between a RAD Section 8 conversion and a Section 18 disposition conversion, like we're doing at the Oak Groves and at Harrison Tower, is the value of the voucher.
Yes.
If you can get HUD to agree to a Section 18 disposition, you get a fully funded Section 8 voucher.
Yes.
If you go through RAD, they just convert the Public Housing Operating and Capital Fund into a voucher. They don't add any money.
Oh.
That's really weird.
Yeah, you know, the as drafted, the statute mandated that this would be a revenue neutral program, so that's why the rents are pegged at the existing public housing subsidies. You know, HUD has subsequently recognized that for a lot of deals that doesn't work, so they offer sort of a hybrid RAD approach where RAD would be offered to 75% of the units and TPVs would be offered to 25%. Typically, that's only available in conjunction with a refinancing and a large rehab. So for all these mixed finance deals, we're currently in the middle of our financing periods, our tax credit compliance periods, and don't really have the opportunity to take advantage of that in a meaningful way. So that pathway isn't really available to us, but as was previously noted, most of these deals are financially stable. We're going to do a little massaging of the rents between the projects to make sure that everybody gets what they need to have a feasible deal, but for the most part, we can accomplish this without going the TPV route at all.
And I would say that, although it sounds very strange to us sitting in Oakland, if you were in Kansas or even the San Joaquin Valley, this program actually makes perfect sense because your public housing cash flows.
Yeah, no, that was my question. What is it that causes public housing to cash flow in these lower costs?
Lowering operating costs. The entire RAD program was initially designed as though it was going to take you $4,500 per unit per year in management costs. Ours are over double that, whether we contract it out or do it in-house. And that's true in most high rental markets.
Oh, I see. So it's mostly then related to the cost of administering and maintaining.
Yeah.
And in some low-cost areas, it is possible to work within those limits.
And it is very much. And that there are housing authorities who operate public housing programs. One that I know for a fact in the San Joaquin Valley that had a very large surplus in public housing over the years. And they actually ended up clawing it back, and he quit.
They clawed it back?
Yeah, they clawed it back, and he lost his – he'd been saving it to do stuff. And, so there – you know, it can be a fairly insidious – school. But that was a perfect RAD conversion because they already were making money. And what it allows them to do is put debt on the property, mm-hmm. which you can't do in public housing, but you have to pay back the debt. So that's where the each property has to cash flow so you can service the debt. If you can't get excess, if you can't get it to water flow somewhere, you're not going to have any money to pay. And it just doesn't work. We even looked at the blended component that Mr. Cadeau talked about. Mm-hmm. Phil and I looked at it twice with HUD while he was here. One time they came out to pitch it to us because we heard they were doing it in San Francisco. And at the end of the meeting, they just admitted that RAD wasn't going to work everywhere. They always knew that, and thank you. What I would say is I think, depending on the direction of the country, but I believe that HUD is taking a very cautious, slow approach mm-hmm. at the staff level toward RAD. You start with the ones that really work now and don't need more money. And that's what they've been. And then you go a little deeper, which is what they've done using the San Francisco model. Mm-hmm. You know, they were the first ones. They were the ones who they cut their teeth on that in San Francisco, where if we give you some full Section 8 and mostly RAD, can you make it pencil? Mm-hmm. So those are ones that are a little better condition. They're going to get to the ones that are really hard, the ones that are in urban markets that have significant amount of deferred maintenance, need real investment, and cost more to manage every month. But they want to weed out the less problematic properties first and get really down to the core. And that could take them another 10 years to gradually increase the carrots to go to RAD.
Right.
And there's going to be some moment in time where RAD makes sense for us, and I would expect everyone to come running here and say, I think we should do RAD now and get out of public housing, project-based everything, and preserve it.
So there'll be enhancements
I think
done
as,
to RAD?
I think that they will, yes. I think they will start awarding funding to support RAD projects so that you get closer and closer to a full Section 8 voucher.
Now, how does HUD handle something? Like, let's say you have properties that are, you know, public housing properties that are way underwater. So you just say, well, this isn't right, and we're not going to have people live like this. So you take some debt on them. So now you're not going to cash flow. And you go back to HUD and you say, hey, we're in some deep trouble here.
Well, you just described the New York Housing Authority. There's no solution.
Oh, I see. They don't come and rescue you. Really?
Yeah, really.
But
they
so these will be Section 8 vouchers?
These will be Section 8 vouchers. They basically are under the Section 8 program. The amount of the subsidy behind the Section 8, the housing assistance, though, is less.
Right. And there are also some of the tenant protections that are afforded public housing residents that are not afforded Section 8 residents under a standard HAP contract are also preserved. So for these deals that already have Section 8 contracts in place, but also a slug of public housing units that will be converted under RAD, they will actually have two HAP contracts with slightly different terms. But materially the same program, there are just some additional resident benefits with respect to things like choice mobility that get added in on the RAD side.
So to the chair. So if I follow your conversation, Director, there's chances that converting, not for us because we're smart, but we could actually lose public housing units or have lost public housing units using the RAD?
Not using the RAD. There has been a great attrition of public housing units, and I would have to Google to find out the total number that have been lost in, for example, the last 5 or 10 years. It's in the RAD. It's in HUD's documents of how many are just out of business, closed down, and don't exist anymore.
They're not livable, right?
Yeah. Well, because they're not livable, and they can't sustain it, and they can't afford it, and they just go out of the and they're or they're closed down because they've been demolished and never built back.
Wow.
It's been the public housing program has been starved for so many years that agencies are able to get out of it, have gotten out of it. If you take that and on top say, I'm only going to give you 50% of the operating because I don't want you to be here anymore, that's the president's message. He's adamant, or that administration is adamant, that we should be privatizing everything, including housing. What I would tell you, my view of public housing is that the only reason it's in this situation is because it hasn't been adequately funded,
right,
because nobody's making money off it.
Right. Yes.
Exactly.
Yep.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you. I just had a really quick question, just so I understand the wording here. We're only submitting the existing policies, not that there are any changes to these policies after the conversion, because
Right. Everything
stays the same. They just wanted us to add them. Is that
well,
correct?
The significant amendment requires that we explain what the eligibility policies are, our admissions policies, as well as any additional occupancy policies that we have. So we're not proposing to change them. We just describe what we intend to implement once the RAD conversion takes place, excuse me.
And what you just said in essence is the plan goes to HUD, HUD approves it, then it's out there for the whole year and anyone can look up and see what's in the plan. We have it on our website now. It went out for public comment, but beyond that, it's in the plan. So if a resident wants to know how does it impact me because I live in Unit 102 at Mandela, and they say it's going to disappear and I'm not going to be in public housing anymore, they can look at the plan and say, this is what you're going to be, and these are the preserved entitlements. And you don't have to go through rescreening. And like a regular project-based Section 8 tenant, you can request to be on the wait list to get a housing choice voucher after a year. It's that sort of stuff.
Good, okay. Good. I like that. And the last thing was just curious about what rent bundling approach is.
Yeah, so basically what rent bundling does, you know, we're already doing it in some fashion through our MTW flexibility. So, you know, HUD has a formula by which they distribute capital and operating funds to each of our public housing properties. Those amounts aren't identical for each property. And if we only did one project at a time through the RAD conversion, we would have to use HUD's formula and what they think we're allocating to these properties, even though that's not often the case as to what we give them, right? Like we sometimes give them less because we take an admin fee off the top, right? But we would still have to give them the full amount of funding that we would give that they would get through HUD's formula as part of their Section 8 RAD rents. If you do multiple properties at the same time, you can combine all of those streams of public housing, operating, and capital subsidy, basically dump them into a bucket and then dole them out as needed to the various properties that are involved in the transaction. Oh. So we've got a half dozen properties. If one is particularly weak, we can take a little bit of money from the other properties, okay, give it to the weak property, and make sure that they're financially feasible moving forward.
Oh, that's good.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Cool. Yes.
I still have a question on the RAD. Mm-hmm. Try to wrap my head around it. Does the ownership, once you transfer to RAD, stay the same? So if it's a mixed finance project, it's still a limited partnership?
Yes, that's correct.
And the length of coverage for the Section 8 vouchers through the RAD is based on what was originally negotiated and what gets negotiated in the future?
There's actually a special provision for RAD contracts where we can offer them either a 15 or 20-year contract, but at the end of the contract, subject to appropriations, so assuming the Section 8 program is still around, we must offer them an extension and the owner must accept it. So it effectively creates a Section 8 subsidy in perpetuity as long as the government continues to fund Section 8.
Wow. Thank you. Mm-hmm.
Okay, and just to wrap up the RAD conversation, we described in greater detail the tenant protections that are specific to RAD that differ a little bit from the traditional project-based voucher program. So we will have no rescreening of tenants upon the conversion or transition to project-based voucher. The FSS, ROS, and Jobs Plus programs all will continue, even during and after the transition to RAD. We have to offer the right to transfer to the Housing Choice Voucher Program, to the tenant-based side of the program, to the residents after 1 year. We currently have an activity where we are able to modify that time under MTW, and we are not allowed to apply that MTW flexibility to the RAD portfolio. We are also intending to phase in any of the tenant rent increases. And we describe in the significant amendment which MTW flexibilities will be applied where possible, and that's the alternative recertifications that we talked about a little bit earlier, zero HAP extensions, which basically extends the amount of time that the project-based voucher family has the voucher program as a safety net, even if they're receiving zero housing assistance. We also include the standardized transfer policy and the ability to accept a lower HAP if the project manager or property managers accept it, just to make sure that we're not displacing any families. So we have various MTW activities that we can use, and so these are the ones that we describe that we expect that we might need to employ during the RAD program.
Okay.
So we have just a couple more slides. We did receive a public comment from Bay Area Legal Aid, and so this slide provides an overview or highlights of the public comment letter that we received. So the comment number one is general, and that comment letter was also included in your packet as an attachment. The comment number one says that the data that we collect should be continually updated to ensure that the services are meeting the needs of Oakland. We also were encouraged to extend the number of mandatory documents that are subject to written translation. This is called vital documents. So the Bay Area Legal Aid was suggesting that we should increase the number of documents we include on the vital document list.
Yeah, these are in other languages, you mean?
Yes, documents that are used in other languages.
Yeah, all these comments are about LEP.
Yes, all of the comments that were in the comment letter, the one comment letter that we actually received, are regarding the language assistance plan.
Oh, okay.
The language assistance plan is included as an attachment to the, or as an appendix to the MTW plan. And so that's why we include portions of the policy in the admin plan and in the ACOP, but we wanted to make sure that we also include it in a place that people can see it, because the admin plan and ACOP are very long documents, and so it gets a little hidden, and if people have language access needs, then we wanted to make sure that the policy was front and center. So we included in our annual plan versus the admin plan and the ACOP. And so the third suggestion or recommendation from Bay Area Legal Aid was that OHA should continue its effort to alert the public of LEP rights, that's limited English proficiency rights to interpretation and translation by providing additional notifications in its offices and other on the website and other public areas. And the fourth comment was that OHA should, the gist of the fourth comment was that OHA should ensure that written policies match policy practices and our procedures, and that this should be verified through a tracking system, a point person to track that progress, and then conduct staff trainings. And so we definitely are taking under consideration all of the comments that were made, and we'll continue to refer to this letter that we received during the implementation and the development of the operational plan for the language assistance plan. We even, you know, we already started implementing one of the recommendations. This comment number four said that we should ensure that the policies match the practices, and so we went ahead and, based on a suggestion in the letter, modified our telephone language line to make sure that it was incorporating all of the languages that we offer and clearly making sure that the prompts matched what the policy says. So we are taking into consideration all of the comments that were included in the letter, and we hope to, over the next, over the next 6 months, be able to fully incorporate the suggestions that apply into our LEP policies.
You know, I was just curious on number four there, because that just sounds like, why would anybody have written policies that don't match practices? I'm assuming that this would be standard procedure, right? If we have policies, we try to make sure that what we do is in accord with them.
That's right. But there are some times where we have, where there may be gaps, where we have a policy that has existed, but our practices over time become more efficient or change. Particularly the example that I'll mention is that there was a telephone, our policy says that we have certain languages that we offer. When we transitioned to the new telephone system, one of the languages got left off of the initial kind of screen of the phone tree. And so because that gets left off, then there's a way you can get to Mandarin, but it's just a little bit more complicated way. It's not as easy as all the other languages. So they called, they checked. They couldn't access the Mandarin line as easily, and so we went ahead and made that modification. And so those are the kind of input from community members that we rely on, because it's just something that got overlooked, I think, in the transition process. But it, obviously our intent is that our practices match the policy. I think what sometimes happens, too, is that policy gets visited annually or less frequently than practices may change.
Sure.
And so sometimes, too, we just have to build in the opportunity to revise our policies, because staff will find a way to make it efficient,
so
for
that's
sure.
That's really almost like a reminder to make sure
that we're going through different quality control checks just to make sure that we, in fact, are doing what we say we're doing. Okay, and finally, the other modifications that were made to the plan during the public comment period were pretty minor, but I wanted to call them out just so that you're aware of them. We made a minor modification to Activity 1701 to benefit landlords seeking prospective HCV participants to rent to. So we allow owners now we propose to allow owners 90 days to find a tenant for the pre-qualifying inspections activity. We also added the RAD significant amendment, which we just described in great detail, and added Mandela Gateway to the planned RAD program.
And we had actually originally intentionally left that out, because we're currently negotiating. Mm-hmm. So Dave thought maybe we could leave it out, and I thought, no, just put it in, because that could go well, and we might want to do it this fiscal year.
We also updated the waitlist section to include an update that OHA plans to open the HCV waitlist during the fiscal year. We added additional description on possible partnerships to expand local programs, as we talked about a little bit before, with local government, through local government agencies. So whether it's local or, city or county agencies, we wanted to make sure we have the flexibility to be able to create additional local programs. And finally, we updated the MTW families number in the housing inventory to 12,000. This is MTW voucher families only. To update that to 12,966 families, which includes a mod rehab conversion that will happen in August of 2019. So we wanted to just make sure that we update the number so that it reflects the planned or expected number of MTW voucher families that we intend to serve.
So what is our wait list timing? The wait list timing.
The wait list opening time?
Timing.
Not sure. Maybe Michelle will be able to tell you. I'm not sure exactly of the specifics.
Good evening, Commissioners. Michelle Assan, Director of Leased Housing. Chair Hurd, the timing is late fiscal year 2020, which would be the fall. One of the areas that we have, as of today, we have moved into our new cloud-based Yardie system, and so we wanted to make sure that we had the new upgraded system in terms of opening the new wait list. So certainly within the next 6 to 8 months, we'll be opening the HCV wait list.
Yeah, and that's not fall 2020 fiscal year. It's actually the end of this calendar year is what we're trying to get it done. We do have people. We've been burning through the current list. We hope to get through it. The other thing, just because they've come and asked, is are we pulling people from the project-based list? We had the first 14 people come in.
Yes.
13 are going to request a voucher. One wants to stay where they are.
Okay.
So we'll be moving that proportionately, just like we described, a certain number of people off the HCV list, a certain number of people off the project-based Section 8 list that want a Housing Choice voucher. So that's all moving. Michelle and I have talked about just trying to turn up a little bit of the volume on our lease up because we think the rental market can support it.
Yes.
We've been in a rental market that's been so challenging.
Yes, it has.
And I think it's now getting more and more accessible. So we're going to try and push that envelope a little bit and see how successful our families are and keep an eye on that. And so we will be calling folks in and doing more leasing. If we can get to the open wait list, and why I really want to get to the open wait list is I believe it's our best shot at trying to house a lot of single-head of household families.
Yes.
In other words, one-person households.
Yes, correct.
And that is sorely missed in this city, and I think we could make a real dent in our unsheltered homeless population if we can get to that population. And they get assistance to help find housing, get through the security deposit. And I will be and have been talking to some of our partner agencies in the county and the cities to make sure that they can have, when we do open it, they'll come up with resources to help those families, those individuals, get through the process.
So that would be one of the priority populations?
Yes.
Are we allowed to do that?
Yes, we do. It's there are preferences, and our preference, first, it's always veterans.
Okay.
Yeah.
Seniors, disabled, homeless, live-work Oakland.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
That's the order. Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you. And that's the conclusion of this presentation.
Thank you.
I would like to just formally thank Julie Christensen, who's the Senior Policy Analyst, for really putting together the 2020 plan with some assistance from Michaela and Stephanie. And we are happy to answer any questions. We intend to submit the plan after your approval sometime during this week, and we hope to hear back from HUD with an approval of the plan before July 1st so that we can implement at the beginning of the fiscal year.
Thank you.
A fine job.
Thank you.
Yes, I'll move it, and I'll echo my chair's thoughts. Truly a fine job. Very good.
Second.
We have a motion.
Do we have a second?
Go ahead. No, she already moved it.
I'll second.
Yes.
Okay. We have a motion. We have a second. All in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Any abstentions? We have a plan.
Thank you. And thank you to Dominica, her staff, but all the other staff that help with this plan every year. It's a lot of work. And the public comment and getting the twice reaching out to our residents and getting input from our stakeholders is always a terrific amount of work.
No, and I actually really appreciate the fact that this is very complex stuff, but it was presented in a very understandable, practical manner. I'm just pointing that out because that's not all that easy to do.
Mm-hmm.
So it's very nice job. Yes. Item B.
Item B, review and acceptance of the Oakland Housing Authority fiscal year ending June 30th, 2018, Comprehensive Annual Financial Report, or CAFR. And I would like to call up our Director of Finance, Victor Mondaba, who will give us a brief overview in a 100% clean audit by the agency.
I know. Hello for that. This is how social justice happens. I kept looking for it.
I honestly, I will say this for the record. I do not know that this agency has received 100% clean audit in the past 20 years.
Mm-hmm. Is that right?
Yeah, I mean, not since I've been here.
I can tell you not for at least the past 15 years.
But we haven't had qualified audits.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Well, on our single audit, I mean, mm-hmm. We haven't, and you're right. We've always had little findings and things to work with.
Good evening, Commissioners and Directors. My name is Victor Madamba. I'm the Director of Finance. I'm here to review and accept the Oakland Housing Authority's fiscal year end June 30 comprehensive annual financial report. The CAFR is a big document, but over 100 pages. Sorry.
Yeah, pick right. Yeah, if you they're not sensitive enough, unfortunately.
Oh, closer. Sorry.
Yeah, just speak right into it, and it'll be fine.
Again, the CAFR has over 100 pages. It's divided in four sections. The one is introductory section, financial section, statistical section, and federal compliance section. So I'll go through each of the sections with you all. Introductory section includes the letter of transmittal. Was written by the executive director and sent to you and submitted for your review. It includes also the Certificate of Achievement for Excellence in Financial Reporting for last year's audit. As you know, our audit is submitted 1 year behind to GFOA for the Achievement Award. So hopefully we get it sometime this summer, another certificate, award from GFOA. Introductory section includes also the org chart.
Could
of the
you
organization.
Kindly tell us the page that you flipped
Oh, I'm sorry. I
so
thought
we
you
can
were,
go with
sorry.
You. Thank you.
So if you go to the introductory section, it's page, my copy. One, two, three, and then.
Oh, gotcha.
The certificate is on.
Yes, beautiful.
Page 5B. Org chart is page 6, org chart of the Oakland Housing Authority. Page 7 is the Board of Commissioners. And page 8 is the leadership team of Oakland Housing Authority. Let's go to the meat of the report, financial section, independent auditor's report. The auditor's report is an unmodified report, means there's no findings, clean audit, as stated by Mr. Johnson earlier. With that report, with that section, it includes what they call MDA management's discussion and analysis of the financial results of the Housing Authority. I will mention the highlights, financial highlights, because that's what's more important to what happened, the results as of June 30. First is the total net position increase from.
And what page are you on?
Sorry? Page 5, sorry. Page 5.
Thank you.
Financial highlights. First one is total net position increased from $393.4 million to $491.8 million as of June 30, a net increase of $98.4 million. The net increase of $98.4, which is offset by a $9.2 million restatement from the implementation of GASB 75 is primarily due to the revenues of $966.5 million, exceeding expenses of $859.5. The second highlight is total assets increase by $64.1 million. The biggest changes contributing to this increase include an increase in unrestricted cash and cash equivalents of $62.6 million. There was a decrease in the net OPEB asset of $12.7 million, primarily due to the accounting changes resulting from the implementation of GASB Statement Number 75, accounting and financial reporting for post-employment benefit other than pension. That's what they call GASB 75, which was implemented as of June 30, 2018. The third financial highlight is capital assets increased by $8 million, representing additions of $17.4 million netted with a $9.4 million charge for depreciation. The fourth financial highlight is total liabilities increased by $3.2 million. Changes contributing to this increase include an increase of $0.9 million in current liabilities to timing differences in accounts payable and other year-end accruals, and an increase of $2.4 million in non-current liabilities, primarily due to the 2.2 increase in the authority's net pension liability. Finally, the fifth financial highlight is the total revenues increased by $154.8 million from $812.4 million to $967.2 million. This increase is comprised of increase in subsidy revenues of $156.5 million, $4.3 million in rental income, decrease of $3.0 million in operating grant revenue, and $1.4 million in miscellaneous and other revenues. Subsidy revenues increased mostly due to an increase in the amount of housing payments, particularly those payments administered on behalf of HUD through California Affordable Housing Initiatives, CAHI, a blended component unit of the authority. So those are the summarized highlights of year-end June 30, 2018. As we go to next page, page seven is just detailed summary or detailed explanation of the increase and decrease of the current assets and other assets of the authority. Unrestricted cash, as I mentioned earlier, increased by $62.6 million, resulting from revenues and increase in revenues from prior year, mainly subsidy revenue. Second, HUD receivables, the authority expects to be reimbursed $20.1 million for administrative subsidy expenditures. Third, net OPEB asset, as stated earlier, because of the change of the GASB 75, there's a net OPEB asset decrease of $12.7 million, remeasurement of the authority's net OPEB liability. The net increase in authority's total liability was $3.2 million compared to prior year due to accounts payable, accrued payroll timing differences of about $1 million increase, net pension liability increased by $2.2 million, as discussed in Note 10 of the financial basics, financial statements. The increase in net position was due to factors below. Net investments in capital assets by $8 million, representing net additions of capital assets offset by depreciation expense. Restricted net position decreased by $12.8 million. Primarily as a result of the implementation of GASB 75 and remeasurement of authorities' net open liability. Unrestricted net position increased due to revenues exceeding expenses after recognizing the change in net position classification above. Page 8 is the revenue. As I've mentioned, revenue went up by $154.8 million. Explanation is below. I'm not going to go through it. Just explanation of how the $156 million was arrived. Same thing with expenses. Expenses increased by $63.2 million. Following the expenses is due to HAP assistant payments increase of $63.7 million.
Well, you know, I just wanted to point out, I'm just noticing something here that kind of stands out, which is that OHA is now essentially a $1 billion operation, I mean, in aggregate operations.
Yes. Yeah. As I say sometimes, we're the second largest HUD funding agency in the state of California.
Yes. And I mean, I think that sense of scale is important, you know, because along with that comes an even higher level of responsibility, And, I mean, that is a lot of money going through this place, so this is...
And there are little victories that we've had. One of them is on the bottom of page 8, where the revenues, if you look at an increase of $4.3 million in revenue in OP, fiscal year over fiscal year, because of lower vacancy rates, I think is really... Mm-hmm. It's good news, not just because of the $4.3 million. It means that we're actually leasing units at a rate that is much higher than historically done, and that's great.
Exactly.
We're serving more families.
Means we are executing.
Yeah.
Yes.
Okay.
Yep.
Continuing on, the next page I want to talk about is page 15.
Thank you.
That's the statement of revenues, expenses, and changes in net position. This statement is presented with two columns. One is the primary government business type, and the other one is the discretely component units. These are the partnerships and the tax credits that the authority have agreements with. If you notice, the authority have a $966 million revenue against a total operating expenses of $859 million. It's an operating income of $106 million. 4% of that is administrative expenses, and 6% of that is operating expenses, including depreciation and amortization. That leaves us 90% of the total expenses is for housing assistance payments. So, you know, just the ratio and the percentage of how we're spending our money is, you know, that's where we're spending it more, is housing payments, and less on administrative expenses, which is 4%.
You said 90%?
90% housing payment percentage, how much we've spent for last fiscal year. The other pages is just the statement of cash flow. It's the sources and uses of funds of the organization. Page 19 is just the notes to financial statements. Those are narrative explanations of the financial statements in the earlier pages. I'll leave that to you guys to read. Let's go to other supplementary information. That's subpage between page 70 and 71, or 71, obviously. Sorry. This is the same combined financial statements as presented earlier, but broken into different programs. Federal, other housing programs, general programs. Uh-huh. Those are the composition of the housing authority programs. Page 73, changes in revenues and expenses, the same thing again, it's broken out by programs. You'll see how each of the programs have paired for the year. Is the statement of cash flow based on that detail. 76 and 77 page, 76, 77 is the detailed of our federal programs. Low-rent housing, mod rehab, housing choice voucher. And you'll see how each of those programs have paired for the June 30, 2018 year end. Okay, let's go to the statistical section of the CAFR. Statistical section is the section is a comprehensive annual financial report that detailed information as a context for understanding what the information in financial statements, note disclosures, required supplementary information say about the authority's overall financial health. Financial trend. This schedules contain trend information to help reader understand how the city's financial performance and well-being have changed over time. This is a 10-year period of trend information. Revenue capacity, the schedules contain information to help the reader assess the authority's significant local revenue sources. Again, this is a 10-year trend information. Debt capacity, this schedule present information to help reader assess the affordability of the authority's current levels of outstanding debt and the authority's ability to issue additional debt in the future. demographic and economic information. This schedules offer demographic and economic indicators to help reader understand the environment within the authority's financial activities takes place, which is the city of Oakland. Operating information, this schedules contain information about the authority's operation and resources to help the reader understand how the authority's financial information relates to the services the authority provides and the activities it performs. So there's a lot of statements in here, you know, 10-year worth of trend information. Again, I'll leave it to you guys to read, and if you have any questions, you know. So the last section of the CAFR is the federal compliance section. This section includes the auditor's report on internal control over financial reporting and on compliance and then other matters on an audited financial statement performed in accordance with government auditing standards and report and compliance for the major federal program. This is the A133 single audit on internal control over compliance required by uniform guidance. In both those reports, the results of the test disclose no instances of non-compliance or other matters that are required to be reported under government auditing standards. Page 7 is where the summary of the auditor's report. Financial statements are issued based on accordance with GAAP is unmodified.
Which, again, what page are you on?
Page 107.
Okay.
Section 1, summary of auditor's results. Financial statements. Type of auditor's report issued and whether the financial statements were prepared in accordance with GAAP is unmodified. Internal control over financial reporting. Material weakness identified, no. Significant deficiencies identified, non-reported. Non-compliance material to the financial statements noted, no. Federal awards. Internal control over major program. Material weaknesses identified, no. Significant deficiencies identified, non-reported. Type of auditor's report issued in compliance for the major program, unmodified. Any audit findings disclosed that are required to be reported in accordance with 2 CFR 200.516A, no. The dollar threshold for this audit, type A and B, is about $3 million. Auditee qualified as a lower risk auditee, no. Section 2, financial statement findings, non-reported. Section 3, federal award findings and question cost, non-reported. So basically, the audit is clean, no findings for the year June 30, 2018. Yes. The page 108 and 109 is just the summarized findings from last year's audit, where we have made corrective action plan and the auditors accepted all our changes on the findings. So you could, you know, look at those and those findings were corrected for 2018. So moving forward, our, you know, this program's working efficiently.
Through the chair, so what do you think attributed to the excellence of this year's audit?
No, I'm just kidding. It's a joke. I'm just kidding. Obviously, I got a tremendous staff. Directors also helped me, assisted me all the way. Since this is my first audit for the authority, so you know, they were there providing all the documentation, information that I needed to put together the audit. My staff worked day and night, you know, to get this done. So I commend them, and I give them all the credit, you know, to get this done.
I also want to add some that it's also other departments. It's IT getting Yardi corrected was the two findings that we've had that were carried over. Had to do with some Yardi controls. The new system fixed it. So I'd like to just throw a real hand to those using Yardi, IT implementing Yardi, getting us those corrections. They're those kind of things. But I would also say, and I just really want to say, I'm very proud of this audit, and it was Victor's first soup to nuts from the close of the fiscal year to the audit, and he's to be congratulated. If he sits here next year and there's a couple of findings, it's because of what they choose to look at every year. And they select what programs, they select files, they review them. And so some of it is just the luck and draw. But I would say that it also is knowing, going into an audit, of how we behaved in previous years and corrected.
Awesome.
Lowers our risk and liability for the auditor, and they become a lot more willing to do audits quickly. Mm-hmm. This one I would also tell you, our auditor is MGO, as you know. They did not finish when I wanted them to finish by, as Victor knows. They put on notice that they went an extra month looking at stuff, and I don't mind that, except that they could have started and gotten it done quicker. I really want the audit done and finished by December 31st, and they went into January. I let them know that one of my big pushes with HUD has been that we have to file something called the unaudited financial report, which goes on by September 31st. Yeah. And then we had to go in and enter the audited financials. And my argument is, we never get even a letter. They've looked at the unaudited till we've already put the audited in. So why are you wasting time?
Right.
Exactly.
Why aren't you making everybody submit their audit within 6 months of the close of the fiscal year, and we can just do it once and be done?
Sure.
So I was a little disappointed this year that we were a little late. It wasn't us at all, I would tell you. The responsiveness of staff were great. But our auditor team was so tied up doing other things, and they kind of delayed in the fall, and it took a little longer.
Okay.
So they're on notice. You know, it's a year-to-year contract. We're going to use them next year, but I really want it in on time.
Oh, thank you. And do we obligated to stay with
auditors? We're not. We did an RFP. We did award MGO based on competitive process. One of the things I really think is helpful in getting it done is someone who has MTW experience.
Right.
They know what CFDA they're monitoring against. And they know the flexibilities, and they know what to look for, honestly, in an audit to pull out what might be a problem for us.
Good.
So
good,
there's you know, it's both. Mm-hmm. They have experience on the programs. They also have experience on what they should be investigating to audit for you.
Perfect.
Yep, that concludes my report. So
just one comment.
Okay.
One comment and question.
Sure.
Well done.
Oh.
Now, my question is, on page 8, when I looked at this, one of the things that stands out for me is the revenue that we made.
Okay.
The revenue. That stood out for me. The revenue that we made.
Oh, the revenue, yes.
It stood out for me. That stood out for me.
Oh, okay.
When I looked at this. And my last question, I wanted to know about the grant revenue. It says housing assistance and other operating grant revenues were $156.5 million due to increases in fair market rents in HUD contracts administered by both CAHI and the authority. That stood out for me. And how does that play out, Director?
Well, if they increase the FMR, all of our monthly payments go up.
Okay.
And so particularly and that was primarily due to the multifamily portfolio, the 41,000, which drives it up.
Mm-hmm.
The other driving factor has, we took some multifamily properties came to us.
Okay.
So we had a couple of conversions. We had, I think, Northgate Terrace, Westgate Terrace, and some, I believe, in Harrison Tower down the street that were on a different HUD program, converted to the Section 8 program, so we got additional HAP payments.
Okay.
But the majority of that is CAHI, I believe, mm-hmm. if not all of it. Yeah.
All right, well, thank you. Yes, my question. Thank you.
Thank you.
Yes. Do you have a comment?
Just a quick question. I would echo the other commissioners in saying that it's really a wonderful audit, and congratulations to Finance Department and you, Victor, and all the other departments that made this happen. And as a Vice Chair Hurd mentioned, it's really wonderful how careful you are of the resources so that there is surplus funds after expenses.
Yes.
for future use. I noted that it said the auditors are dependent on the audits by other auditors, or the financial statements presented by other auditors. So that's for the partnerships, I assume?
Yes, the discreetly.
Yeah, so, in other words.
So it's really a compressed timeline, because they have to get those from those partnerships. Yep. As part of their overall
that
audit.
Is such an astute observation, and the executive director will pay attention to that, because it could have caused some of the delay that I am blaming them for. I didn't really think about it. That could be why they were late, and I didn't even consider that. I'd have to drive back. Armino and Associates does the majority of the other audits, some other audits are done by, for example, the Mandela Partnership has to submit it, Lion Creek has to submit theirs to feed into ours.
Yeah, it's a huge ball to roll up the hill.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, there's a lot of roll-up of financial information.
But they still do the in-depth auditing of the internal systems, especially.
Yes, okay. NGO does.
Yes.
That's what I, okay, great. Thank you.
Well, I just want to say that I am personally very impressed with this evening, because what we have seen here with the MTW presentation, that is really the execution of the mission of the Housing Authority. And now here we are seeing the financial results and financial plan that has come out of that. And to get a unmodified, which used to be an unqualified, this is really a big deal on an audit. And this, as most of us know, the Oakland Housing Authority is an extremely complex organization. We have all kinds of subsidiaries, and we have joint partnerships. We have all of these things going on. And this is all just well organized and clear, and it is possible to really understand this level of complexity, both in terms of strategic and tactical execution of our mission and in terms of the numbers. So I really feel that we have been witnessing the evolution of excellence here. And, you know, I've been here a long time, I guess longer than, a long time. And the changes that I have seen here are really, truly impressive. So this is really a congratulations to the entire organization, because you can't do this sort of stuff without every single component being on point. So thank you all.
Thank you.
Thank you. Do we need a motion to accept?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yes, we do need a motion.
Yeah.
I'd like to place that motion.
We have a motion placed.
And I'll second the motion.
Seconded. All in favor? Aye.
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 Any opposed? Any abstentions? No. Carries.
Great. Thank you, commissioners.
Item C.
Item C, I put on the agenda because of some recent information that we've been providing you on the FMRs that HUD has released. So I'd asked the Director of our Leased Housing Department, Michelle Hassan, to put together with Dominica Henderson a short presentation just explaining HUD's issuance of the FMR and what we are doing on our side to counterbalance their reduction in rent. It doesn't require board action. We can adjust fair market rents or our voucher payment standard without that.
Cool.
But I wanted to get out there in public with what we are doing. So I'll turn it over to Michelle.
So I'm happy that you got good news for the first two presentations. Michelle Hassan.
Pressure's on now.
Michelle Hassan, Director of Leased Housing. Commissioners, I will present information on the fair market rents that were recently approved by HUD. I will seek some additional comments from Executive Director Eric Johnson and Dominica Henderson, as both of them were involved in the request for reevaluation. So I wanted to give you some background on fair market rents. And fair market rents are used to determine the payment standard amounts for the Housing Choice Voucher Program and other programs, and the flat rent levels for public housing. The FMR is the basis for determining the maximum monthly subsidy for an assisted family. HUD annually establishes FMRs for defined metropolitan areas. FMRs are posted at least 30 days before they are effective, and they are effective at the start of the federal fiscal year, which is October the 1st. HUD must provide a procedure for the public to comment and request a reevaluation of FMRs in a jurisdiction before the FMRs become effective, and that is really important for Oakland. So just to give you a timeline, August 31st, 2018, the Federal Register issued the fiscal year 19 fair market rents. The comments were due October 1st, 2018, and the fair market rents were effective October 1st, 2018, unless HUD received a request for reevaluation of specific FMR areas by January 11th, 2019. So what is HUD's methodology? HUD basically, in general, the fair market rents for an area is the amount that would be needed to pay the gross rent, the shelter plus utilities, of privately owned, decent and safe rental housing of modest, non-luxury nature with suitable amenities, and is typically set at the 40 percentile range of gross rents. Now, I've said that to say that part of what HUD is looking for is they use this, what's called the American survey. HUD stated in the August 31st Federal Register that the only difference in the methodology for FMRs as used by HUD for fiscal year 2018 FMRs is the use of more recent data. HUD determined since the American Community Survey used fiscal year 2019 FMRs from 2016 and larger Oakland, for fiscal year 2019 FMRs, HUD used data from 2016 to 2018. Therein lies our problem. So the rents that HUD are using in our estimation are not valid for our market area. Base year rents are set by HUD. For fiscal year 2019 FMRs, HUD used the U.S. Census Bureau five-year American Community Survey, the ACS, collected between 2012 and 2016, and released those in December 2017 as the base rent for the FMR calculations. They utilized two-bedroom recent mover data, and our area is called Oakland-Fremont Metro Area, and that's used for all of Alameda County as well as Contra Costa County. So the question is why HUD's methodology does not work for us. And I'll have maybe Domenica come up and share some information that Stephanie Hawk was able to provide in our reevaluation request to HUD. But essentially, the formula relies on inaccurate, out-of-date rental data. The methodology includes improperly defined metrics, such as an arbitrarily low public housing rent cutoff. And the proposed FMR calculation in October 2018 included significant substandard rounding down of the rents that HUD used for our calculation.
What does public housing rent cutoff mean?
I'm glad you asked. So I'm going to read these prepared remarks because I wanted to make sure I'm keeping it as simple as possible because it's a very complicated calculation, and then I'm happy to answer any questions.
Well, just generally, I don't necessarily need to.
Well, the public housing rent, I'll skip a couple things, but the public housing rent cutoff is essentially, so regulations require HUD to eliminate non-market or luxury rents. So non-market means the low side, luxury is the high side, generally. And so as a result, the formula to calculate the base rent level, and that's the level from which HUD then adds on additional adjustments to increase over time for inflation and things like that. So the base rent level includes certain metrics that we argue are low, and result in possible negative impacts to OHA's FMR level. And then there are other components of the methodology that exclude data that benefits OHA's FMR, but they seem excessively high or a luxury to HUD. So for example, HUD excludes all rents that are below a certain level or the rents that it deems that are federally assisted. While there's no question on the American Community Survey or the 10-year census that says, is this federally assisted address, HUD can use its judgment to determine the public housing rent cutoff or what is the level, the floor at which they determine is a federally assisted rent when they're conducting surveys. And so for the Oakland Fremont metro area, that level is $445, meaning a renter in the Oakland Fremont metro area paying as low as $446 a month would be included in the base rent calculation for the metro area. So it brings down the average for the base rent calculation. So basically, they're going through doing surveys of all the 2-year recent movers, and anything that's zero to 445 is cut off. They exclude it from the distribution. 446 and up to a certain level, they include it in the distribution to set the base rent. What we argue is that somebody paying $446 a month in rent is probably not an unassisted or market rate rent level. And so it's arbitrarily bringing our rent level down. And once the base rent is starting at a lower level, then no matter what the adjustment factors are that they apply to them, it's already at an inaccurate base rent foundational level. So the public housing rent cutoff is the amount where HUD says, we think these rents are federally assisted. We think these rents are not typical of the market. And so we'll exclude those from the distribution and from the calculation. That number, the actual number, is $445. So that means that 446 on up is what we include. And we argue that it should be something closer to $1,000.
Oh, I see.
Right.
I see. Right. That explains it. Okay.
And I also wanted to mention that our argument is that obviously that the public housing rent cutoff is too low, it's not fair, or it's not an accurate representation of what we find rent levels to be anywhere in the metro area. So whether it's Oakland or Berkeley or Martinez or wherever, we find that rent cutoff is just too low. And then there are also other factors that are included in the methodology that we argue are inaccurate or just not a true depiction of what rents are in this area. And so we included those in some comments from since October. And so I also wanted to just clarify one thing as well. HUD does not release what it considers proprietary or personally identifying information that might be necessary in order to help the public or us fully understand the calculation. And so in October 2018, HUD asserted that HUD basically publishes a calculation, but it's not the actual calculation because the actual calculation uses census information and that has Dominica Henderson at this address, blah, blah, blah. So they just do it in general. And the public version of the calculation differs from the proprietary data that HUD is using to make that calculation. And for OHA, or for, I'm sorry, for the Oakland Fremont metro area, that difference accounted for a $424 decrease in the FMR that was published. And so what they're saying is basically the public calculation uses rounding because you don't have access to the actual data. So if we're rounding, we ended up with a $424 higher number than HUD's actual calculation. There was no explanation for it. There was no real detail behind it. And we were the only jurisdiction, even higher than San Francisco, which is always the example for everything, right? Mm-hmm. But we were the only jurisdiction that had that high an unjustified or unexplained rounding issue. And so $424 is significant, and so we wanted to see the detail behind the calculation to be able to explain that. When we brought that up to HUD in a letter, there was no clear explanation provided. The statement on rounding then was erased from the website, and it's still our assertion that we that the rounding is impacting us in a negative way, and we need to be able to explain that. And there's no way to be able to explain that or justify that rounding and that significant a decrease in amount without some background or some detail.
Without having it, yeah.
Sure. So I just want to say this is so in the weeds, as they like to say in D.C., but if you want to have the fight in the weeds, we're going to have the fight in the weeds on this issue because it's so hurting this area.
Well, it's critical.
It is critical. And two of the talking points the chair and vice chair will be taking with them in meetings with Congresswoman Lee, who's been amazingly supportive through this process, has written letters, made calls, as usual. And I didn't get into the packet because on Friday we were going kind of back and forth with her staff, and she wrote what it was a flawless letter. But they sent me a copy. I don't have the signed version yet, to the secretary demanding an explanation in simple terms. But what they will need are people like Dominica and Michelle and yes. Andreas and Patricia and you introducing it to actually explain in the detail with HUD and help push the fight, because we have two things that we are actually saying. We want this language changed in appropriations so this kind of madness can stop.
Yes.
We may not get it, but we definitely need to ask for it.
Yes, exactly.
Yes. So I wanted to talk about what our response has been since the FMRs were published. In fiscal year 2018, published FMRs reduced by HUD in 2016 for Oakland Metro area and Alameda County. In December 2015, area PHAs and other nonprofits paid $109,230 for a local survey. The survey results provided increases in FMRs for fiscal year 2016. In fiscal year 2017, FMRs increased slightly by 3 to 4%. And fiscal year 2018, FMRs increased by 7 to 8%.
Wow.
So we were doing really well for a couple of years. And in fiscal year 2019, just so to give you background, in January of 2019, there were 13 areas that submitted a request for reevaluation. that included Oakland, Fremont Metro Area, Boston, San Francisco, Santa Clara, Portland, San Diego. And 10 areas were approved by HUD, including Oakland. So we were feeling fairly positive. The fiscal year FMRs published in October 2018 reduced our fair market rents by 9 to 10% across all unit levels. Unit sizes. We submitted the reevaluation, and collectively we paid $134,900 for that survey. HUD then published the new FMRs March the 14th, 2019, for our metro area, and we got an increase of only 1% from the 9 to 10% decrease. So we're still lower than 8 to 10% of the fiscal year 2018 rents.
Okay, so I just want to repeat that. The 1% was on the HUD published 10% decrease.
Yes, right.
Not on
Got
what
it.
The FMR currently is.
Right.
Had they increased our current FMRs by 1%, I would tell you I agree with that.
Mm-hmm.
And I agree with that based on third party data that even the mayor has issued in her report, saying that rents in our area have gone up roughly 1% in the past 12 months. So if they increased our FMR, current 2018 FMR, to the 2019 by 1%, I think they got it right. They didn't do that.
They reduced it, right?
They reduced it by
like
about 8 to 9%.
When it went up by 1%. Yep. Right, that's beautiful.
And certainly, just to put it in context with our landlords, is it absolutely makes it difficult for our families to compete in the open market.
Right. Yeah.
And so our approach, because the FMRs are able to go in a range between 105 to 110, OHA must increase its payment standards up to 110% of the fiscal year FMRs just to maintain current levels.
In other words, not have people experience rent reductions.
Yes. Right.
And that is not going to be true throughout the entire metropolitan area, because some of our neighboring housing authorities are already at 100%, 105%, and they don't have the 8-9% to go. So they do have certain, and I've supplied, by the way, a list of them by bedroom size, by agency, to Congresswoman Lee's office, so she's very much aware and making other Congress people aware of the situation HUD's put some housing authorities in, because they're going to have to reduce rents on existing families.
So is this a new development? Because I thought that we had, I don't remember what the time frame was, but sometime back, I thought that we had pretty much resolved this problem where we had gotten we'd gotten HUD to agree.
We did. But it comes back to bite us, because every couple of years they redo the rent survey.
I see. And we go through it again. So they went and resurrected the trouble.
Yes. And this time we did another rent study. We again split it with neighboring housing authorities and nonprofit affordable housing providers, profit and nonprofit, both kicked in for it. Unfortunately, we submitted a list of comparable rents to HUD. They excluded some of them and said they're too high. And that's the detailed data that they won't provide us.
Why don't they just look at Zillow?
Well, actually, they are actually prohibited from using asking rents and rent reasonableness. So they can't go online and look at what people are requesting for rents. So that's not something that they would allow us to do.
They think people are lowballing and still getting the apartment.
They are.
And
what we're going to do is go up to 110, keep everyone whole. Yeah. That works right now.
Okay.
But if we're at 110 and they do this again to us in some way, we're in trouble. Yeah. And because we're not going to be able to do that.
Are we funding this out of our own money?
Yes, and out of our HAP money. So it may be that as the year progresses, there's going to be fewer people served because we expend 100% of what we're allocating for HAP. But I think we do have the leeway to do it, because we serve people in other ways that we can make up the difference. Dominica has taken a look at what all MTW housing authorities have done around this. We have that list, and we're considering bringing some ideas forward on how we can use MTW to help basically fix this problem.
Okay.
But the legislative one we're proposing, we're doing because our neighbors can't do it.
Okay.
And we may be back before you in the next year making a recommendation in the plan next year. This is what we want to do for us. But that is not going to fix it for any surrounding jurisdiction. What would fix it is a couple of lines in appropriation. So we're going to suggest that to the Congresswoman, which will be reiterated next week when you meet with her.
Okay.
And maybe she can carry the baton for us.
Cool.
And she is on appropriations, by the way.
Oh, nice.
Cool.
I have a question. Does the regional HUD office help in any way to advocate on your behalf? I mean, they're more cognizant of the regional rents, or?
The rents are determined through a certain silo of HUD, and we have been in direct email, at least one person talking on the mic has been in direct email exchange with this issue, and it is my belief, and Andreas did actually go down and speak with them when they were presenting in Santa Barbara. We were used as an example of almost an example of egregious rent increases from our 2016 study.
Mm-hmm.
It was very clear to me in our email exchange that he did not believe that we warranted the kind of increase that we got last time.
Okay.
And I believe we are being punished and corrected now, and I just think that's ridiculous, personally. You know, I don't know what they think they're accomplishing by doing that.
Punishing the people.
Yeah. Exactly. We're not. I know.
That are
I know.
Innocent.
As I pointed out in my email.
So I want to give you a visual of what those FMRs look like.
I think, Barbara, do you have something? Barbara.
The survey, the nonprofits paid for the local survey, and the housing authority pays for a survey. Is that, I mean,
this agency paid 50% of the cost of that survey, I would tell you, because we're the largest.
What
did it accomplish? At the end, it accomplished submitting to HUD within the guideline, one, postponing implementation of the 2019 rents, so we did delay it. Had they taken our data on the survey, we were expecting about the same FMRs as we currently have. We were not expecting them to adjust those numbers, exclude rents, and take us down by 8%, giving us a small increase over what they were proposing. So it was an exercise somewhat in futility. It should not have been. HUD should be transparent, I believe, with the data they're excluding and tell us and give us a reason why.
Yes.
We had over 200 we submitted in the survey. It was done by a third party, and it was done correctly, and we actually even paid addition to have additional survey responses so that they had more to choose from. And honestly, they must have excluded more, but we don't know. They won't release it to us. So as far as we know, they took a dartboard and threw a dart and said, okay, we're gonna give them this. Seriously, I think that needs to change, and I think that that's part of what we need to put in the appropriations, requiring HUD first to use local or regional data to adjust rents forward, and secondly, Dominica's working on this language because it's in out of my job classification to truly understand the depth of what she's proposing that is our problem. HUD understands it, and I'd say that Dominica and particularly Stephanie understand it, and I think the world needs to rely on us to propose that language to say stop doing this and be transparent and release the data that you're basing the rents on as well. Well, I think just one other response. I think it gave us something to fight about.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that if they're going to do this to certain jurisdictions that they might choose to do this to for reasons that may be political, what we want to say is quit doing it. It should be a database decision.
So I wanted to give you a visual of fiscal year 2018 to fiscal year 19, what has happened. In the first column, you see what the fiscal year 2018 FMRs were. The next column is the fiscal year HUD proposed FMRs. So this is what HUD published in October of 2018. OHA and surrounding PHAs proposed the third column, which again starts with the 1721. And then finally, the final FMRs that were approved by HUD are noted in March the 15th are noted in the final column. So we lost per bedroom, we lost $131 in efficiency, $149 in one bedroom, $203 in two bedrooms, $294 in three bedroom, and $359 in the FMR rents for our four bedrooms. And those are significant when families are searching for units and are in competition with open market renters. So the fact that we can, at a minimum, go to 110% is what our plan is, and that has to be implemented as of April the 15th. So a notice will go out that OHA will set its payment standard at 110% of the FMR, just to keep the fiscal year 2018 FMRs in the first column.
So as I look at this thing, if I'm looking at three bedrooms, just because I have some familiarity with that, so HUD originally proposed $2,900, right?
$2,902, yes.
And then we proposed $3,573.
Yes.
And then HUD came back and went just under three.
Correct.
I see. So that's where we're sitting right now.
Correct.
Interesting. Thank you.
And so what we intend to do is maintain the first column, which are the fiscal year 2018 FMRs for fiscal year 2019.
$1,000
a bedroom on the four bedrooms?
Yeah. Right.
The next slide just kind of gives you a visual in terms of you can see in 2019 that all bedroom size rents have decreased. And so essentially what HUD is telling us is that the market in 2019 is fairly close to 2016, that there have been no gains in contract rents.
Mm-hmm.
And somehow I need to explain that to our owners. But
you're living in a fantasy world.
But that really is what we're talking about. If you can look at this, it is pretty amazing where we are. In three-bedroom rents in 2019, the FMR is lower than 2016, mm-hmm. if you can note that.
That's amazing.
And so we'll just have to do, I think our landlord incentives are going to be timely, because yes. that'll be a way that we are able to attract mm-hmm. landlords.
Yes. If I can make a comment?
Yes.
It just, with these numbers, it just seems that our families will be in poverty longer, because you can't even work yourself out of the units. These amounts are just extraordinary.
Yeah, so that is the max. So that's the con. If you look at these in context to our language, these are really what we're talking about is like the contract rent, because the family's only paying 30% of their income.
I understand that.
Yeah. Yeah.
But what I'm saying is that we have working families that, you know, progress
yes.
in their career. And, you know, I did that. I progressed and I incomed out.
Mm-hmm.
But the rents are so high for some of these low-wage jobs or mm-hmm. even yes. middle-wage mm-hmm. jobs that they will stay in poverty even longer.
Yeah.
More dependent right. on us even longer
yes.
as
Absolutely.
Long as these rents stay
yes.
where
And
they
what
are.
You're talking about, I think, mostly is just the ridiculous wage inequity that exists in this country
exactly.
as it relates particularly to housing.
Yes. So that's just the story
yes.
underneath these numbers.
Yeah.
I mean, families, if you're not subsidized, how you afford rents in the Bay Area? It's mm-hmm. very hard to imagine. And so there are some policy options. Again, the regulations 24 CFR 982 provides that OHA may establish the payment standard at a level between 90 and 110%. HUD approval is not required to establish a payment standard amount in that range, and we just made it. We were at about 109.3,
yeah.
110 for 3 and 4 bedrooms right there. And I think 108% for the 1 and 2 bedrooms.
I'd also say this has, if we didn't do this adjustment, has a really strong negative impact on whether or not our development deals will cash flow.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Yes, 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 totally. Because that will determine whether the project-based vouchers
yep.
are working, right?
Yep.
Yep.
Yeah. And we do have, as you know, a number of PVVs in the pipeline, so many of them were, you know, at a minimum counting on the fiscal
yeah.
year 2018 FMR. So
yeah.
at least they stay there and don't decrease. And then, yes, sir.
No, I was just going to say, so HUD will allow, so if we're pegging the rents at 110% of FMR, HUD will make that adjustment, right, to our payments, our HAP payments.
No, they give us the HAP dollar amount. And that's what we live with.
They give us what?
The total HAP dollar amount is what we're entitled to. If we go to 110% voucher payment standard, there is the possibility over time we could serve fewer families. Now we.
So they don't.
They
won't.
And to give you an example, San Francisco is currently at 110% with exception rents. They have exception rents are beyond that, which HUD has approved. They're serving roughly 21% of the total number of households.
Mm-hmm.
That HUD thinks they should be able to serve with the money, but they've ran out of money.
21%?
No, 71.
Oh, huge. Okay. That's still low.
Yeah. Yeah.
Have you calculated how much going to 110% will cost the Housing Authority this year?
So right now, we fiscal year 2018, we're at essentially the 110 payment standard. Okay, so we're maintaining that, but we will see that more families will probably need more of that subsidy.
Mm-hmm.
So we expect that we'll use more of the budget for rents and subsidies for families.
Yeah, it will use more of the budget to serve the same number of families.
Yeah.
And what about tenants who can't afford it?
Well, right now, the families are not going to be affected as much because basically they're paying 30% of their income for rent. Commissioner Hurd, what happens is as owners want higher rents, it could affect the families because everything over 30% the family will pay for, unless you're in a PVV. Mm-hmm. PVV, your rent portion is at 30% of your adjusted income, and the housing authority pays everything else. But for Section 8 families, as owners want more rent and our payment and our fair market rents aren't increasing, and the families want to stay in those units, they could elect to stay in a unit and actually pay more than 30% of their income for rent.
Yes, I see.
And that's a trap. Mm-hmm.
So that's how it can impact our families that are currently
in units.
It's
just a horrible thing.
Thank you.
The bright spot is that we're MTW. And we have Dominica Henderson and her team really to look at if there are any activities that we need to plan for and suggest that could in the future mitigate this happening to us again. So some other housing authorities that are MTW have done some creative work around this issue. And so we'll be looking at that.
I mean, what we're trying to do here is so reasonable. It's just, it's bizarre that it's so difficult. It's just bizarre. But it is.
This, again, just gives you an idea over time what has happened. It's one of the, I think it's the same slide as 8, but just gives you a broader range of when we go up to 110%, what that will look like. You'll see on each side of the chart, essentially we will be continuing with our fiscal year 2018 payment standards. And it tells you the range between 105 and 110% that we need to implement to just stay at fiscal year 2018. 109.3, 108, yeah. 109, and then 110 for both three-bedroom and four-bedroom. And that concludes my presentation.
Thank you, Michelle.
Thank you, Director. Now, the worst case scenario is that we're going to be paying extraordinary amounts over for over 50% of the units. But I don't think it's going to be that bad, right?
I mean, it's going to be
a percentage of the units.
I agree. And I think we're going to, and we'll talk about it more when we do the budget presentation. I think we're going to, it's financial impact.
Yeah. Good.
Okay.
Thank you.
Perfect. You're very welcome.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Move on. Boy, wow. What a world we live in.
Moving on to item D.
Item D
is consideration of a resolution authorizing the executive director to execute a two-year contract with three additional one-year option terms in an amount not to exceed $480,000 for the initial two-year term and an additional $240,000 for each one-year option term if exercised with Booster Fuels Incorporated to provide on-site mobile fueling services. I think this is a wonderful idea, and I would like to turn it over to Andreas Manriquez, our COO, to give a brief presentation about what we're doing and why we're doing it. Andreas, I'll turn it over and I'll be right back.
Okay. I hope I'm brief. Good evening, commissioners.
You hope you're brief.
Okay. So talk about innovative in the sense of, you know, moving to create new ways of, you know, us becoming more efficient. And this is one of those, you know, items. Currently, we buy fuel, you know, for all of our vehicles. We have 165 vehicles through a piggyback through the county of Alameda. And that piggyback, with San Francisco and San Jose. And there's five other entities that buy, purchase fuel from this source. And that includes, you know, CHP, California Highway Patrol, the Sheriff's Department, the Oakland School District, so forth and so on. Basically, what we do is we pay the regular amount of the price for a fuel plus 13 cents, per gallon that we, you know, purchase, you know, from them. So we engage into this, you know, RFP, you know, to basically look for a company that would come over and deliver fuel for all of our vehicles. And what that means is it means that, you know, if we have a company that comes and, you know, delivers the fuel, we have staff that are no longer, you know, in their vehicles refueling their, you know, vehicles. And what that allows us to do is to put our staff to work where we need them to work while, you know, someone else takes care of refueling, you know, our vehicles. You know, tentatively, this would be something where they come in, you know, at night, all the vehicles are lined up, and they just come in and fuel all the vehicles. This concept actually has been working on in big, you know, companies, Facebook, Western Digital, Yahoo, several other, you know, companies use this, you know, concept. And the concept was they don't want to see their executives fueling their vehicles, so they'd rather just, you know, have someone come and do this, you know, for them. So that was basically the idea. Let me see. Okay. One of the things that... In terms of cost, because you would think that the cost would be very high to have someone to actually do this. But the concept is that if there's a gas station, they have a lot of overhead expenses. There's the real estate, you know, there's all the taxes, there's, you know, a lot of things that they have to do. When you have a mobile gas station, you don't have those expenses. So then that offsets, you know, what, you know, we would be paying, you know, for that. So now if we take, for example, that we have, you know, a person that, just for sake of argument, I'm not saying that this is the case, but makes, you know, $50, you know, an hour, and we have, you know, 50% of benefits, you know, that's $75 per hour. And if that person is spending, you know, an hour to go and refuel a vehicle, you know, that is a lot of time and, you know, money that is wasted. So in terms of, you know, us, we, you know, would be paying around 80 cents, 85 cents per gallon in that, you know, extra charge, you know, because the fuel is very competitive. And thus, if it's a vehicle that has 20 gallons, you know, it'll, you know, probably be around $18 for us to fuel that vehicle rather than paying someone the cost of, you know, labor, you know, plus the mileage to go to the site to actually refuel the vehicle. So that's basically the concept behind, you know, this. Right now, we, spend around, we purchase around 4,000, you know, gallons of fuel, 4,000 to 5,000, depending on, you know, conditions, you know, per, you know, month, you know, on a constant basis. And that's a, you know, all, you know, housing authority wide. So, you know, we think that we're going to have, you know, a lot of efficiencies by keeping our staff, you know, working and not refueling, you know, the vehicles.
Sounds good.
Do you want to add, you know, something, you know, Mark?
Just to kind of echo for what Andres has said, it's more about getting more time to go out and service the residents than to spend driving across the city and stopping for gas at the gas pump,
yeah.
Which the only gas pump we have now is the one that's the Alameda County gas pumps, which is right up the street here. So if you're coming from East Oakland down to this side of town, depending upon what time of day, mm-hmm. it could you've probably been stuck, sure, in that traffic before.
The gas we use is through the county, and that's at the, yes, Alco. It's at the Alco Circle parking lot.
Right. Mm-hmm.
So when it saves time for that, and I also just think it's greener. It's better that this person goes by periodically and fuels up all the vehicles at the site, and they don't have to drive them here, and they can go to the, yeah,
right,
when they're centrally parked. So I just thought it was a great idea, and I just want to see how it works, and I'm excited about trying it out.
Yeah.
But mm-hmm. other than staff time savings, will we get fiscal savings too, financial savings too? Or is this, how much is the gas compared to what we're getting now?
The gas is, you know, pretty comparable, you know, because you would think that the gas would be more expensive,
right,
but the idea is because they don't have that, all that overhead, you know, cost, then it's much more competitive, you know, and of course it fluctuates as the oil prices go up and down.
Okay, so it's kind of flat, sort,
yes,
of. So
that's,
it's
correct,
the same amount of money, but they come to us.
Correct.
Yeah.
Okay. Right. And just in case are we in a long-term contract with these folks? Because just in case it doesn't work out, can
no,
we
No, not at all. We can actually stop it tomorrow if it doesn't work out and stay
good.
With the county. So right. You don't burn a bridge with the county, and we try out something new.
Exactly. No, I like it's a good idea. I was just curious about how much we would save, and that just wasn't in there. So let us know.
I think the majority savings is actually going to be staff time. Mm-hmm. The 2 hours it might take to go get gas from Lockwood. Yeah.
Getting gas is a pain.
Oh, it is.
It takes time.
And that's not just Mark's staff. I mean, this is also for the police officers. They can come by and refuel them.
Yeah, right.
It's wherever we have fleets existing that can take advantage of it. So officers don't have to spend time getting gas if they can go down the service center and fuel their vehicles at once. Yeah.
Does it include our inspection folks too?
To the ones that are in-house. And they actually use four Priuses here downtown. So keep in mind that's contracted out as well as in-house. But we only have four Priuses that are designated for inspection in Michelle's shop, which isn't huge, but yes, it does include them.
Okay.
I would say the downtown fleet has the easiest time fueling because it's just around the corner.
Yeah.
Right. So when would this go into place?
Yeah, once we actually execute the contract, it's up to us as to when we start.
Like tomorrow?
How do they get the keys to all
that would be ideal.
Next week?
It won't be tomorrow, but it'll be once the board approves the motion, then it gives me the authority to execute the contract when it's ready.
And then, one other perk is that we will be getting a lot of, reporting, back from, the vendor. So we would be able to, monitor this very, very accurately.
And the quality of gas is?
By vehicle.
Yeah.
The quality of gas.
It's the same quality of gas that you would get from the gas station.
I'm sorry, what was that?
Same quality gas you would get at the gas station. But to Andres's point.
Which gas?
Very good question.
Okay. There are different kinds of things.
But to Andres's point, you could really go straight down into, and we can get reports now on vehicles for the cost, for how much gas they're consuming, but this would go direct because they visit each vehicle.
Yeah.
I move approval.
Okay, we have it moved.
I'll second it.
Seconded. All in favor? Aye.
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 Any opposed? Any abstentions? We have gas.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mark. Thank you, Andreas. Moving on to item E.
Yep.
Item E is consideration of a resolution authorizing the executive director to increase the contract purchase order for Kodama Diseño Incorporated in the amount not to exceed $300,000 for additional architecture, construction, administration, and engineering services for the construction and renovation of 1619. This is continuing a contract that came before the board several years ago. Mm-hmm. It's as needed, so we can continue to have the contractor, the selected architect, finish the management of the contractor during the construction period here at 1619. I don't believe we're going to need $300,000, but I am asking for it just so that we have, if we need additional design work during the course. But he also has to monitor and attend all the meetings and sign off on a number of things. Unfortunately, Mr. Bailey had to leave early today, so he's not here, but I want to just, on behalf of him, give the report, and we're here for any questions.
Thank you.
As you've noticed, work has started. I'm very excited, by the way.
Yes, I did notice that.
So you want to move the
Move end? It.
I'll second.
Move it.
Second.
And I'll second.
Second. All those in favor, aye.
Aye.
Any opposed, abstentions? Carries.
Thank you, Commissioner.
Architects. Now we're going to F.
Item F is just a general discussion of the recruitment process for the hiring of a new executive director, which just kills me to say that, by the way, and the establishment of a recruitment ad hoc committee. But time is time, and we'll start with just a brief report from the chair, if you want.
Yeah, okay. So, fortunately or unfortunately, I've been through this process before. I say unfortunately because I know that how difficult this is. And but in any event, so we are going to form a committee, and that will be myself, Commissioner Lee, and Commissioner Castillo on the committee. And Commissioner Lee, would you like to chair this committee?
No, it's the same committee.
No, this is the same thing. This is selecting a new executive director. We have to recruit them before we select them.
Right. So it'll be the same committee through the process.
Oh yeah, we're all in all the way.
I just want to think about how much time it will involve, and can I?
Yes, and you could do that. Get back. Right. Okay. That's fine.
Very good.
That's fine. Now, so just to, so how does all this break down and who does what here? So the real purpose of this committee is to do a lot of sort of the administrative stuff here. And to, so part of it is, I believe the RFP has already been written, mm-hmm. so we don't have to get involved in that now. But it will be, we need to select a recruiting firm. Now, this is not really as big a deal as you might think, because there's very few of these people to choose from. Mm-hmm. There's like maybe only three, I believe, is what I've been told.
There could be more, but yes, there's definitely three that we've worked with.
It's a small, you know, it's really a small universe. So, mm-hmm. so our plan to just kind of be efficient and avoid another full board meeting would be to have the committee make that selection. And if anybody has any issue with that, you know, or doesn't think that's a good idea, just speak and bring it up, and we can discuss it. But the idea right now is we will pick the firm, and then the firm will put the notice out that we are in the market for a new chief executive. And usually these firms, because they have some experience in the market, they actually know some people that might be worth talking to. And then the other thing that the committee will do is they will do like a top level, what's the right word to use here? Kind of like the word I have on the top of my head, I don't know, is really a cool word to use, but well, it's kind of like weeding out, you know, the screening. Yes, perfect. Thank you. Yes. So we're doing a top-level screening of people that we just think really are not going to be suitable. So once that list is down to a small number of people, then we go into the big interviewing, which will be a full board participation. So we will all be interviewing the final. The mm-hmm. Yeah, we have to do that. I mean,
and
because otherwise we won't be able to make a decision. And then of course the final full board makes the final decision. And we'll, you know, the committee will have recommendations and whatever, but that's in a nutshell the process.
That's it. And I would just add a couple of things, that we will be releasing a request for proposals, and it's been drafted, it's been reviewed by Jennifer and Daniel Mermelstein's here. Staff have already vetted it and ready to go. So we got all that to go. It'll go out on Thursday. Within that, there are certain things that it's going to ask. One of the things it's going to ask is, before developing and releasing the flyer or the brochure, they're going to contact each one of the board members to get some input about the kind of candidate, what should be in it. So that we'll get one point of input from them. What we really want to do is, when we get the proposals back, then the committee will make a selection. It will be within the executive director's authority figure, so it won't be above 50,000. It won't need to come to the board. So we'll get someone on board. Hopefully, it'll happen in May. I'm hoping that we get the proposals back. I'll give you the dates. November or April 4th is when it will be posted. We'll have questions from any proposal by the 18th. We'll do the addendum by the 24th, and we'll have responses due by May 2nd at 10 a.m. So we think that in the first week or two of May, if the committee can meet, and we'll get you copies of the proposals, and we can make the selection and evaluation of the proposers, decide who the recruitment firm should be. Once we hire the recruitment firm, then we start the process. I've asked them to do certain things, engaging the board at different times. One of them is initially, so that you can get some input of kind of what you would see and what you'd like in the brochure. But also I've asked them to, with the steering committee, discuss what a process should be. There's many ways to do this. You know, we did it one way when I was selected. I've done it another way in Los Angeles, and I've seen it done a third way by the County of LA. So I've been involved in three of these that I've seen different things, and I think that a good recruiting firm can come forward and say, these are some ideas that worked here or worked there. I think it's very important to let that person do their job well, and that is to advise us and get us through this process. But that would be, as a timeline, we're looking at trying to get a brochure somewhere published in the midsummer, doing the selection times and all of that, you know, by August, September, and maybe having a selection in somebody by October is the kind of broad schedule. And there'll be plenty of time for input and designing what the actual process is going to look like with the ad hoc committee and the rest of the board's input.
Okay.
All right?
Thank you.
Thank you so much for allowing me to sit on this committee.
Well, thank you for volunteering.
I'm really excited to continue to keep the excellence going, what you built here under your leadership. You've left us in such an incredible position, and the next person has got to meet that kind of level of excellence. And so that's why I really wanted to sit on this, to make sure that the legacy continues.
That's right.
And so in that respect, I would just want to make sure that the board has completed its responsibilities to Eric. I know that he never got a evaluation. So if do we need to do anything before he leaves?
Well, we are, I would just say that we are actually, you know, there have been a number of things that interrupted that review. And so obviously now.
That's just an example.
So, right. No, that's a really important question. Because our current plan, I mean, we could decide to go another way, but our current plan has been to continue with that 360 review.
Oh.
Now that is going to depend on what the timings of these are. And the reason we were going to do that, well, there's two reasons. One is we feel that input from that kind of a review may help inform us as to some of the things we might not have thought of that we want to ask a new executive director candidate about or dive into. So that's really the primary reason. And there's this kind of secondary reason, is that it just kind of feels, I mean, I know Eric knows that we all appreciate him, you know what I mean? But I mean, I think that there's just something that seems not right about having a chief executive officer and never having any feedback, salary adjustments, nothing. I mean, so we might want to really do something here before he walks out the door, even though it's kind of, late on in the game. So that's our thinking. But nothing is like 100%, you know? So we could once we get into committee, we start talking about all this stuff, we might decide that, you know, we can't do all this stuff. It's just too crazy. Mm-hmm. But we'll see. So that's the
but
thought.
But I appreciate the comment. And the board has always been so supportive of me personally and professionally that it's been one of the great reasons to stay longer than I probably would have.
Thank you.
11 years total. Yeah, 11 years, about 9 as the executive director.
Now, how long have you been executive director?
Since 2008, and I think in 2010, so this is 9th year as executive director.
Yes.
You mean it was 9 years ago we went through this?
I told you, I got old before your eyes. You just watched
me. Oh, my God, this is, like, incredible. I mean, I remember that like it was yesterday because it was kind of like.
I remember when you came to us and Sean.
Yeah.
Yeah,
11 years ago.
Stress out.
11 years ago, actually, in March. Mm-hmm. End of February, March when I started LHA. Yeah. Yep. Yeah. It's been a wonderful city and a wonderful board to work for, and some great staff that have done some crazy stuff with me over the past 11 years. And I think we're all better because of it.
Yes. No, we're rolling
and
forward.
And I would be remiss if I didn't recognize certain wonderful residents that I've gotten to know well in the audience, yes, who I think give me personal courage to get through every day, I have to tell you. But all that aside, I just really want to, aside from the 360 discussion or anything else you'd want to do, that really the focus should be to get someone really good in this chair.
That is the focus.
That's what if you want to do something that would make my day, would make me happy forever, you'll get someone really wonderful here.
Yes.
Well, it's not going to only be making you happy.
Right.
This is critical to us and to 300 and whatever number of employees that are here that have families. And we have 15,000 families that we are supporting out here around the city of Oakland. So this is a big deal. Yes. And we all realize that it is a big deal. And for those of you who have not been through this before, wait till you get in the middle of this. Boy, it's really, no, I mean, it's just stressful. It's stressful because you're making a decision to hire one person. You know, and if you're wrong, it's a real bummer.
Yeah.
There's a lot of downside to making a mistake.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Okay.
So there we are.
Very good.
If there's no more questions, we're going to go to item next.
I don't have a question,
next,
but I have a comment.
G, and we have no one here.
There are no comment
cards.
I have a comment.
Yes.
I have to say, being today is April Fool's Day, I wish item F was an April Fool's joke.
Oh.
But it is
that
not.
Is a sweet thing. Yes.
And Thursday, I'll have reached my 8th year anniversary working with Eric.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you see, Eric, this is the person that works most closely with you.
She survived 8 years of doing that and still has a smile
like
on her face.
She did more than that. Yes. Yes.
Excuse me. I am sorry that I was late in my arrival. I was too late to fill out the speaker's card, but I would like to know if I could speak.
Yes.
Yes.
Yes, you can speak.
Yeah, just move that mic over.
Definitely.
Betty Lou Wright. This is addressed to you, Mr. Executive Director. I have known you for 8 years. I have known you to be not only the Executive Director, I've known you to be a friend, I've known you to be a confidant, but most importantly, I have known you to be a leader. From here and here combined, I have seen you, I have listened to you, I have heard others talk about how you are approachable. Many times chief executives stand aside on their self-made plateau and no one can reach them but just their executive staff. You have been open and you continue to be open to criticism, good and bad. You continue and have been open to residents and non-residents. You've always been open to hear, to listen, to evaluate and reevaluate. And I thoroughly appreciate what you have exhibited to me, an Oakland resident, a very vivacious senior citizen of 79 years, a member of RAB, but most importantly, in my volunteer work with OHA, I have been able to see you in ways that the public has not. At no time have I ever been ashamed to say, this is Eric Johnson, Executive Director of Oakland Housing Authority. wherever you may go from here, whatever pathways you choose, whatever pathways come before you that you haven't chosen, may you know that you would leave here with much love, with much respect, and always you are a part of OHA. I'm glad that you're leaving, only because you're leaving at a time that you can still step forward. You're not leaving at a time where you are ill and must be confined in a residential facility for medical patients. This is a time to continue to step forward, to run, to jump, to do whatever you want to do. So for that, I'm happy. But then there's the other 51%. It will never be the same without you. You're going to be missed. But your legacy is here that will be added to the gentleman that served before you and to the female or gentleman that comes after you. But I bid you to go in peace with much love and joy. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you so much. All right. Thank you.
I can't say anything. I'm sorry. She knows I can't.
Neither could I.
All right. So I think we're adjourned. Motion to adjourn.
Motion to adjourn.
Oh, wait. We have written communications.
Oh.
And certainly we're available to answer any questions. And in a historic first, I have no announcements to make tonight.
What?
Awesome.
I don't.
So. Awesome.
I don't. I decided not to.
Just as a point, on page 17 of the report, it says January 2018 and February 2019. Is that an error, or are we actually looking at 1 year apart? Okay, thanks.
Yeah.
Okay, I just wanted to make sure.
Boy, good catch.
Yes.
Well, the numbers are significantly different.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Okay, then. Okay, so we're good then. We don't have any committees.
Do have the rest of it, which is reports from committees and commissioner announcements.
Yeah, I was just going to say that I don't believe we had any committee meetings. Yeah. I think we're good with that. Do we have any announcements by commissioners? And then if not, then we're looking for a motion to adjourn. Wow, that was amazing.
That was quick. Yes, Victor.
Please.
The motion was to adjourn in honor of Victor McElhaney.
Yes, very good. Excellent.
We need a motion and a second.
Join in memory of Councilperson McElhaney's son, Victor.
McElhaney. Yes. And then a second. And we're good.
A second.
Okay, then we are adjourned, right?